Democracy is not a game played in an institution that rubber stamps a government. Democracy is not one obsessed man using the power of kings to attack another country in our name.
America's real problems are being hidden behind the smokescreen titled War, which only diverts attention from the real problems of a failed economy and a failed domestic policy.
We ought not politicize this war. We ought not politicize the rhetoric about war and life and death.
President Bush's plans to attack Iraq meet heavy opposition both at home and abroad. This is Imperatives for Peace, Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration is pressuring Congress and the UN to grant him authority to wage a preemptive attack against Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Bush wants to reserve for the U.S. the right to attack any potential enemies before they strike. If passed, the UN resolution would guarantee unlimited access to Iraqi sites with the go-ahead to strike militarily if Baghdad fails to comply, an idea that's meeting with opposition both domestically and abroad. Former Vice President Al Gore has entered the debate, weighing in against any preemptive attack, which he says could actually weaken our ability to win the war against terrorism.
I believe that we ought to be focusing our efforts first and foremost against those who attacked us on September 11th and who have thus far gotten away with it. The vast majority of those who sponsored, planned, and implemented the cold-blooded murder of more than 3,000 Americans are still at large, still neither located nor apprehended, much less punished and neutralized. I do not believe that we should allow ourselves to be distracted from this urgent task simply because it is proving to be more difficult and lengthy than was predicted. Great nations persevere and then prevail. They do not jump from one unfinished task to another. We should remain focused on the war against terrorism. And I believe that we are perfectly capable of staying the course in our war against Osama bin Laden and his terrorist network while simultaneously taking those steps necessary to build an international coalition to join us in taking on Saddam Hussein in a timely fashion. If you're going after Jesse James, you ought to organize the posse first, especially if you're in the middle of a gunfight with somebody who's out after you. I don't think we should allow anything to diminish our focus on the necessity for avenging the 3,000 Americans who were murdered and dismantling that network of terrorists that we know we're responsible for it.
Former Vice President Al Gore says the fact that we don't know where Al-Qaeda is shouldn't mean we focus on some other enemy whose location might be easier to identify. U.S. Representative Jim McDermott in Baghdad this weekend says Bush is willing to mislead the American people about whether the war is needed. The Washington State representative says the administration has gone back and forth between citing supposed links between Iraq and the terrorist network Al-Qaeda and Saddam's supposed attempts to obtain weapons of mass destruction. Even some Republican lawmakers are raising questions about the administration's war agenda. During a Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing last week, Republican Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana grappled with the issue when questioned by Committee Chairman Joe Biden.
Is there a plan? Do we have any idea what we plan to do in Iraq after we win the war? How do we stop the fragmentation? All the testimony we've had from the Iraqis who came before us before was simply to confirm a very complex country with many nationalities and divisive groups, Iran coming in from one area, Turkey from another. This is very tough business right now.
Senator Yield, and every one of those witnesses said the United States has to be the one to manage this.
Yeah, so we come back to that. Now, maybe the United Nations, and you're probably both right, we ought to have tried to make sure there are a lot of other helpers to help pay for this, as well as sustain it for a period of time. But let's take the worst-case scenario. It is us. Do we have any idea, any plan for how to bring about peace in Iraq, the territorial integrity, peace with the neighbors, to get the weapons of mass destruction? Now, maybe somebody in administration does. Maybe even as we speak, there are people who will come and say, we've thought of those things. We haven't told you about them. And they're highly classified, but that would be reassuring.
Senator Richard Lugar, in defense of his administration or his agenda, Bush accused Senate Democrats of putting party politics over national security issues, and in doing so, ratcheted up the tenor of the debate. Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota.
No one here needs to be reminded of the consequences of war. No one here should have to be admonished about politicizing the debate about war. But, Mr. President, increasingly over the course of the last several weeks, reports have surfaced which have increasingly led me to believe that indeed there are those who would politicize this war. But then I read that Andy Card was asked, well, why did this issue come before Washington and the country now? Why are we debating it in September? Where were we last year? Where were we last spring? And Mr. Card's answer was, from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August. New products? War? And then I listen to reports of the Vice President. The Vice President comes to fundraisers, as he did just recently in Kansas. The headline written in the paper the next day about the speech he gave to that fundraiser was, Cheney talks about war. Electing Taft would aid war effort. I guess right from the beginning I felt, well, first it was pollsters, and then it was White House staff, and then it was the Vice President. And all along I was asked, are you concerned about whether or not this war is politicized? And my answer on every occasion was yes. And then the follow-up question is the White House politicizing the war? And I said, without question, I can't bring myself to believe that it is. I can't believe any president or any administration would politicize the war. But then I read in the paper this morning, now, even the president. The president is quoted in the Washington Post this morning as saying that the Democratic-controlled Senate is not interested in the security of the American people. Not interested in the security of the American people? You tell Senator Inouye he's not interested in the security of the American people. You tell those who fought in Vietnam and in World War II, they're not interested in the security of the American people. That is outrageous. Outrageous. The president ought to apologize to Senator Inouye and every veteran who has fought in every war who is a Democrat in the United States Senate. He ought to apologize to the American people. That is wrong. We ought not politicize this war. We ought not politicize the rhetoric about war and life and death.
Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota. But the administration has said there will be no apology, and thus the Congress grows more sharply divided over the issue of war with Iraq with every passing day. Senate floor hearings on a resolution could begin as early as tomorrow. Today, UN experts and Iraqi officials are meeting in Vienna to resume weapons inspections of Iraqi plants. The goal is to determine if Saddam Hussein is secretly developing chemical and biological weapons. The Bush administration believes Saddam is not only developing them, but has already given his field commanders conditional authority to use chemical weapons in the event of a U.S. attack. A breakdown in communications of the talks between Baghdad and the U.N. would strengthen the U.S. case to use military might. U.S. Representative David Bonnier of Michigan, also in Baghdad, urges the U.S. to move forward in a way that's fair and impartial, without the U.S. and Iraq dictating the terms. Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, follows the U.N. and joined us in our studios in Washington this morning to react to the latest developments.
It's hard to know what will be on the agenda in Vienna until that meeting finishes by the end of Monday or perhaps on Tuesday. I think what McDermott and Bonnier were referring to is the fact that there's a pre-existing agreement that was signed between the United Nations and Iraq that details how UN inspectors would go about the inspection of particularly private places, if you will, what were known as presidential sites, areas that included the presidential palaces, and other areas where the Iraqis were particularly concerned about issues of symbolism and national sovereignty, that sort of thing. And they signed what's called an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, between Iraq and the United Nations, detailing exactly how the inspection of those places would go forward. There was never the view that they wouldn't be inspected. It was just an understanding that there would be certain precautions taken so that the dignity of Iraq's government would not be completely undermined, as it has been so often.
Now, what role is the U.S. likely to play in this new inspections team, given the fact that the last weapons inspectorate, known as UNSCOM, was closed down in 1999? The inspectors were pulled out in 1998 after it was made known that Washington had used American members of its inspections team to spy on Iraq.
One of the big differences between the current team, UNMOVIC, and the earlier team, UNSCOM, is precisely in the makeup and accountability of the team. UNSCOM was made up of military and intelligence officials from the U.S. and Britain more than any other countries, some others, but mainly U.S. and Brits, who were paid by their own countries, who were essentially seconded to the U.N. from existing positions in the military, in the CIA, whatever. Now, the rule is that UNMOVIC is staffed by UN employees. They're full-time staff of the United Nations. They're paid by the United Nations. They're not allowed to be working two jobs, essentially. Mm-hmm. That's obviously not a guarantee that there could never be another spying incident, but it makes the likelihood of it far less serious. And I think the Iraqis understood that distinction was a very important one. The broader problem of what role the U.S. is playing is on the political or diplomatic front, where it appears that the U.S. is doing everything possible to ensure that the inspections not take place at all. Mm. They're trying to provoke the Iraqis into walking out of the talks in Vienna, trying to set traps, hoping that the Iraqis will respond in a rather ham-fisted way, as they so continuously do, without taking seriously that this is the opportunity to make real the commitment to disarmament.
Well, in fact, the fact that the UN is going ahead with these weapons inspections in spite of the objections on parts of certain members of the Bush administration seems to put the U.S. in a very precarious position internationally. What kind of reaction is the Bush administration likely to have to this moving forward with these inspections?
I would say, Verna, that if it was any other country doing what the U.S. is now doing, you would be right to say that it makes them somewhat vulnerable. So it's a precarious position. Because of the overriding power discrepancy between the United States and every other country or every other group of countries, it's much less precarious and I think much more dangerous at the international level. There is certainly the danger that the U.S. is going to use the combination of bribes and threats and punishments that they've used so often at the UN and used so overtly 12 years ago in the run-up to getting UN endorsement for the war against Iraq at that time, that it will be impossible for other countries or the United Nations as a whole to stand defiant of the United States. That could prove not to be the case, but right now we're seeing a very precarious position, not of the United States as much as by the British and the Russians, who so far are maintaining their position of opposition to the idea of what the U.S. wants in the new resolution that's on the table. And in fact, over the weekend, we saw a stand down by Tony Blair from his originally very hardline U.S. identical position to one that accepted the French view of a two-part resolution rather than a single resolution that would include authorization for the use of force. If that stands, if that position by the British stand and the French and the Russians maintain their current level of opposition, there is the possibility that the U.S. will not get the votes that it wants in the United Nations Security Council. In that case, the U.S. would then be in a very precarious position diplomatically, unfortunately not as precarious militarily, if they were prepared to go forward unilaterally.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering if Tony Blair's decision to stand down had anything to do with the hundreds of thousands of British that turned out over the weekend for a mass rally in London.
It had everything to do with that. The 350,000 or so Britons who appeared on the streets of London, as well as his having to face this weekend the party congress of his own Labour Party, where he is thoroughly isolated and being accused of being Bush's poodle for his uncritical stance in support of George Bush. All of this kind of action had everything to do with his standing down from his earlier position.
Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Bush's determination to deal with Saddam Hussein with or without international support is wedging a growing gap between the U.S. and many of its U.N. allies. As many as 400,000 people marched through central London this weekend to protest his plans for a war and to demand justice in Palestine. This as Baghdad rejected the draft U.S.-sponsored U.N. resolution requiring Iraq to comply within 30 days or face military action. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair are desperately seeking international backing for their Iraq resolution. And yesterday, at the opening day of the Labour Party conference, Blair pleaded with his party to trust him to deal with Iraq. But many are concerned Blair will deploy British forces alongside Americans if the UN plan fails. This weekend, politicians, lawyers, students, families, and activists took to the streets to protest against Britain's role in the war campaign. Miranda Kennedy reports from London.
Crowds of people clogged the streets of central London on Saturday, slowing traffic throughout the capital and streaming past the Houses of Parliament. Many of the marchers were first-time demonstrators, and many were Muslims. Even small children joined in with the citywide mood of protest. Hours after they left central London, hundreds of thousands arrived at the massive rally in Hyde Park. Among the speakers at the rally were three British members of Parliament, two bishops, and the Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. He said that President George Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair were going after Iraqi President Saddam Hussein for reasons that have nothing to do with his weapons of mass destruction.
There is only one regime in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons, and it's not Saddam Hussein. It is Israel, who have had nuclear weapons for 30 years, and there is no action being planned to take those nuclear weapons away from Sharon. How can you send British troops to die in a war in Iraq when they know the vast majority of the British people are opposed to that war? The British people don't back you, Tony Blair. There's been enough casual death of Arabs. Stand up to America. Listen to the people here today and the people that voted for you before. Make sure you say no to war.
Several weeks ago, 50 members of Parliament signed a statement disapproving of military action in Iraq without the sanction of the United Nations Security Council. Now, as U.S. and British diplomats try to ram their resolution through the Security Council, Blair has to fight to convince his own party not to undermine his efforts in Iraq. Protests against the war loomed over the opening of the Labour Party conference yesterday. Last week, Blair released a dossier on Iraq that he said provided new and persuasive evidence that Saddam Hussein is expanding his weapons program. But the dossier was greeted critically by many, including some of Blair's allies. American former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter was one of those critical voices, as he told the rally on Saturday.
Mr. Blair, I too share your concern about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, because I know more than you what Iraq had and what had been accomplished in the field of disarmament. I know that while we did not account for everything in regards to Iraq's weapons, and there are still things to be done in the field of disarmament, that weapons inspections do work, can work, and will work if allowed to go back into Iraq unfettered by manipulation of the United States and Great Britain. This document is not a case for war. This document does not make the case for war. This document is not worth one drop of blood from an American soldier, a British soldier, or an Iraqi civilian.
Demonstrators came to London this weekend from all over the globe. Osmi Bashara, a Palestinian member of the Israeli Knesset, flew from Israel to attend because he hopes the leaders of the world will listen to their own constituencies, the people of Britain and America. And he wanted to make clear the connection between the destruction of Palestinian rights and the plans for war in Iraq.
The connection has a name. It's called Richard Perle, Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, George Bush, the same policy which is planned now against Iraq, the same policies are the policies that adopt General Sharon unconditionally and without any critique.
Salma Yacoub, a Muslim woman from Birmingham, did not have as far to travel, but she made the trip even though she is pregnant because she wanted to be somewhere where Muslims and non-Muslims were standing together for peace. After September 11th, she says, she saw her family suffer from the hostility towards Muslims, and she was racially attacked for the first time in her life.
It's no accident that while the world has been remembering and mourning the attacks of September the 11th this month, Bush and Blair have launched their war drive against Iraq. Indeed, this pair has been busy cashing in on that tragedy for a whole year now. The good news is that people are waking up. Never before have we had a position where an anti-war movement was this strong even before a war was started. Tony Blair, in his offensive drive, has now been put on the defensive.
A BBC poll released late last week found that the vast majority of the British public opposed military action against Iraq unless there is clear sanction from the United Nations. Asked who was the greatest threat to world peace, 43% said Saddam Hussein and 37% said George Bush. This weekend's demonstration represents the voices of the real moral majority, according to Australian journalist John Pilger.
Today a taboo has been broken. We are the moderates. Bush and Blair are the extremists. The danger for all of us lies not in Baghdad, but in Washington. Only one country has used a nuclear weapon of mass destruction against civilians. Only one country has threatened to use nuclear weapons in Southeast Asia and the Middle East. Only one country has torn up all the treaties that were forged over years to prevent this happening. Only one country is developing nuclear weapons for preemptive use, and that is the United States. Tony Blair belongs to George W. Bush, not to us. If he joins the attack on Iraq, he will kill untold numbers of innocent people, and he will promote the kind of terrorism that endangers the lives of all of us. Blair and Bush are the true enemy within. They must be stopped because other countries will be next. Iran, North Korea, perhaps even eventually China.
Labour Party activists are determined to show Tony Blair that he does not have the support of his party. And organizers say that the massive turnout of a wide cross-section of people at the protests this weekend prove that he does not have the support of the British people. For Pacifica's Imperatives for Peace, this is Miranda Kennedy in London.
The Labour Party continues their annual conference in Blackpool today, and many expect rancorous debate over what will be their official stance on the goals and possible action in Iraq. George Galloway is a four-term member of Parliament and senior vice chair of the Labour Party's Foreign Affairs Committee. He is a staunch opponent of any military offensive in the region. Randy Zimmerman with Pacifica affiliate WMNF in Tampa and headlines editor for Free Speech Radio News spoke with Galloway in the days leading up to the conference.
You were a very big critic of possible military action. Can you tell me a little bit about some of your apprehensions?
Well, I think I'm with most people in the world that we see on our television screens and in our newspapers the results of the wars that are already going on in the Middle East region. And the idea of starting another one with a quarter of a million Western soldiers invading and then occupying an Arab Muslim country is simply berserk. The idea that we can be safer from international terrorism if we set the Middle East further ablaze is just foolish. And then there's the issue, and I don't mean to be offensive to American listeners, but there's the issue of the leadership qualities of the American president himself. Now, some, including Mr. Blair, have said that we are misunderestimating Mr. Bush, as he might put it. But most people in Britain and in Europe have seen the president and listened to him, and they think they're estimating him just about right as a man not fit to be driving a car along the edge of a cliff.
How do you explain Prime Minister Tony Blair's support for Mr. Bush's proposals?
Well, it's bizarre, really, and shows just how fickle he is in his affections for American presidents. He had the closest possible relationship with President Clinton. And yet he's found himself on the wrong side of an argument between George W. Bush, who's a prisoner of the hard right faction of the Republican Party, and Al Gore, the inheritor of the Clinton mantle. He's found himself against Nelson Mandela and with Dick Cheney, who voted to keep Nelson Mandela incarcerated on Robben Island when he was a U.S. congressman. He's finished up against Gerhard Schroeder, our sister party leader in Germany, and with Richard Perle, the Prince of Darkness, and Paul Wolfowitz, who used to make even Ronald Reagan's blood run cold. So it's a very bizarre thing, and the more that the U.S. president heaps praise upon Mr. Blair, virtually decorating him as America's PR man, the more uncomfortable Labour people, and even non-Labour British patriotic people, become.
Help me understand just a little bit of British politics. How is it possible for Tony Blair to commit troops and support without having the support of the Parliament?
Well, you made the right decision several hundred years ago of getting out from under this ancient and fundamentally democratically flawed state. And you have the great benefit of a constitution. We are one of the few countries in the world that does not have a constitution. And the Prime Minister in Britain has what's called the royal prerogative. That is to say that the only person who can make war in this country is the monarch, and the monarch has vested that power in the Prime Minister as an individual. And that's why Mr. Blair is able, and I suspect will, take Britain into a devastating conflict of momentous consequence. Without even a simple vote in the Houses of Parliament. And this is a democratic outrage, and one of which more and more people in Britain are deeply ashamed.
Do you think it's possible, one, for Tony Blair to wind up backing down? And if so, what will cause that to happen? Because also Donald Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense here, has said that while publicly a lot of folks are against this and want to try UN sanctions, they also find the evidence very compelling, and the international community more so is on the side of the United States.
Well, this is a self-deception on an Olympic scale. The truth is the vast majority of people in the world are watching with dread the role of this great juggernaut of war and are filled with terror at the consequences that may emerge out of it, the economic consequences, the regional consequences. and the consequences for the rest of us in the radicalization of this monster of fundamentalism. And Donald Rumsfeld, whom I may say has been widely photographed here, meeting Saddam Hussein in 1983 in the middle of the Iran-Iraq war, handing over new satellite surveillance pictures to the Iraqis, the better to target the Iranian army with chemical weapons. Mr. Rumsfeld chills the blood of most people in Europe. They look at him as they looked at the Dr. Strangelove character, and he's even got his arm in a sling, rather like Dr. Strangelove himself.
What does Prime Minister Tony Blair have to gain by supporting the United States proposal and President Bush?
Well, he has everything to lose. What he has to gain, I suppose, is if everything I've been saying turns out to be wrong, then he will have been vindicated and his position will be immeasurably strengthened. But if even half of the things that I'm saying turn out to be correct, then he will have destroyed his premiership. And for what? You'd really have to ask him. He speaks with a catch in his voice that the special relationship is all to him. Now, I'm actually not against the special relationship. I myself feel some kind of special relationship to the people of the United States. The problem is, it's the kind of special relationship that Monica Lewinsky had with Bill Clinton. It's one-sided. It requires us to be on our knees. It's completely undignified, and it's easily disposed of as soon as the stronger partner wishes to dispose of it. And we've seen that in all sorts of things. The steel sanctions that the United States put on, which threw thousands of British steel workers onto the unemployment line. The Kyoto Protocol, which Britain believes in and the United States has trashed. And all the other multilateral issues like the International Criminal Court and others, where the unilateral attitude of the Bush administration has ridden roughshod over international opinion.
Randy Zimmerman with Pacifica affiliate WMNF in Tampa, speaking with Labor Party member George Galloway. Thousands of protesters turn out in this country for peace. You're listening to Imperatives for Peace. We'll be back in a minute.